you don't have insurance anymore. There's no 401k, there's no options, nothing. And our biggest realization at that point was, my time is money. If you would have told me then I would have any sort of consulting firm at any point in time, I'd be like, you're crazy. Like, I don't know anything about any of that. If you would have told me I'd be in sales then, I would have probably laughed at you. I was a consultant for quite a while before kind of scaling, growing that business and needing to hire more consultants. So doing the job and working a lot, because at that point we had grown quite a bit, I realized it was like, we need to bring somebody else in. Like, I can't keep, you know, at one point I had 35 direct reports across like 5 different companies for fractional management, driving myself crazy, driving my family crazy, especially at first. Those first 2, 3, 4 hires are very critical. After that, I think by that time you should have a framework as far as some training and some pieces, so you can potentially bring in some junior consultants that will fold in nicely into some of those kind of smaller engagements. But, you know, I would say towing that line of finding someone who's knowledgeable within your space, who's hungry and eager and motivated, at the same time, humble and willing to check their name at the door, like you did.
Amazing. I was going to say, you're not talking about me anymore, are you? This interview is with an old friend of mine, Pete Mickarts, who's currently the director of sales at Verisat. Throughout the first half of my discussion with Pete, we delve into the story of his sales consulting venture, 0 to 20. We explore Pete's leap of faith from a stable full-time role to the unknown realm of entrepreneurship, which was driven not just by ambition, but also by a bit of destiny. Listen to the interview, and I promise you're going to gain some very valuable insights as Pete shares firsthand experiences from pioneering a solo consultancy to scaling 10 bounce practice with a team of consultants. Then during the back half of the interview, we run through some hot topics such as the transformative power of AI in sales, the evolving dynamics of remote versus on-site work environments, and the future trajectory of sales development. We wrap up with Pete's candid opinions on the significance of social selling, thought leadership, and the delicate balance between individual talent and organizational culture. Let's get into the opening question here. Take us back to, November 2020. You were leaving Beyond. And or at least around this time, I think it was the inception of 0 to 20, the consulting firm that you started and are founder of and still run today. And I think that came from a conversation you mentioned to me once that, you know, it was the CEO of Beyond kind of encouraged you to go down that path. Take us back to that moment in time in your life, in your career, and talk about kind of what was going through your head. What was the thought process of going from being, I think it was director of sales, to starting your own thing?
Yeah, it's, I guess first I should say it was kind of a weird transformational, kind of psychotic time, if you will. You didn't, you know, you're young, you just left a great company that was doing well, and you kind of are thrown into the situation of now what, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember having a conversation with the CEO of Beyond, one of the founders. And he was like, you know, obviously you have a knack for very early stage companies, like pre-series A, series A companies, and growing them to that, you know, $10, $20 million ARR level. And it, him asking that question, him actually just even highlighting that, was the first time that I had kind of reflected on my experience to date, right? And been like, actually, yeah, I am pretty good at this, right? And I do enjoy it because it's messy. It's messy, it's fun, but the end goal is to get to this beautifully, you know, crafted, driven, repeatable, forecastable, like sales process, right? And sales engine. And to get from, you know, inception of the first few customers, even the first 100 customers, to $20 million in ARR, there's a lot of dirty work that you have to do to get there, right? A lot of dirty work that spans everything from marketing, CS, sales dev, sales, product. Like, there's a lot of people that have to come together. And granted, I am not saying I am that person with the glue to hold all that together by any means, but you do have to really spread yourself pretty thin at times to understand, you know, different competing priorities within the company while maintaining that drive towards revenue to ultimately make the company successful, right? And it's really what I enjoyed doing. And to have a CEO say that obviously you're pretty good at this, was really impactful for me. And that's when it all really started. And oddly enough, I think it was like the day or two before that conversation, I had been in a couple conversations with other companies that wanted me to consult, right? Really? And I had not even put those two pieces together at all yet. That was like, oh, they're asking me because they've heard or they've talked to me or we've had a bunch of different conversations, right? Where they think I can provide value to this company, and that both companies were very early stage. And literally, I remember hanging up the phone, talking to my CEO, going and talking to my then, I think it was girlfriend, not even fiance at the time, who's now my wife. And being like, I think I might start my own thing. She's like, go ahead. Yeah, let's do it. So, I mean, without even skipping a beat, she has been the cornerstone, the rock to everything, right? So, that's really where it all began, and was like, okay, you know, I have been pretty good at this. Let's give it a shot. Why not?
When you think monetarily about this, though, what were, yeah, what, it, what, how are you mitigating your risk and your downside? You know, like you had some people that were reaching out to you. I don't know the scope of what those engagements might have looked like, and you know, they're not always highly lucrative from a money side of things. Were you apprehensive? Were you weren't in a good place? I'm thinking about the sales consultant that's listening that is at the precipice of making that decision themselves.
Yeah, it's daunting for sure. I mean, to leave any, you know, multiple six figure, much less multiple six figure job, right? And to have literally hit that reset button the first of that month, the following month, you're not making anything, right? And you don't have insurance anymore. There's no 401k, there's no options, nothing, right? And there's multiple kind of factors that go into this. Obviously, I wasn't married at the time. I have a beautiful 14-month-old daughter now, right?
Hi,
Could I have
Austin.
made that decision today? Hi, Austin. Probably not. But then, right, I was young enough, wasn't married, didn't have a mortgage yet, was still living right in downtown San Francisco.
Oh well, that throws a wrench in things. Downtown San
I
Francisco.
mean, when I say that though, it's not necessarily about the financial impact that it is. It's more of like I'm in the mecca of if I'm gonna make
Good
this
point.
work,
You're in the
it's
right
gonna like
place.
I'm giving myself the best chance to make this work here. I can literally just walk down the street and go to South Park and hang out at a coffee shop and probably run into a dozen people by noon that I could potentially work with, right? Prospects, if you will. So,
Good
you know,
point.
the decision to do it financially. Of course, that was a detractor. At the same time, the two engagements that I had kind of teed up, one was basically 20 hours a week, kind of almost 50% of the time. And it had a pretty lucrative monthly cost or monthly income to it. So it's like, okay, even if it's just this one engagement, right, which was a month-to-month engagement, so it wasn't like I was stringing a year-long contracts or six-month contracts together. I was like, if I can maintain this one agreement, I know at $120,000 a year, I can live at least, right? And I
Build
may
on
not be
this.
eating out a couple times a week or, you know, driving the same car or anything like that, but I know I can live. And that's what really was like, okay, I can bite the bullet, let's do this, right? And anything on top of this, you know, was gravy. I think the biggest reflection or biggest realization at that point was my time is money, right? And of course, we've always heard executives say that. Like holding meetings with a bunch of people, right? Which you definitely should think about. But it was right then I was like, okay, I'm getting paid hourly to do my work. I need to make sure that that hour I'm as fruitful and productive as possible, not only for myself, but also for the end client to retain this client for as long as I can, because they are essentially my base salary now. As long as I can keep them, they're my base salary. Right. And lucky enough, it was a great company, great founder and CEO. Shout out to Aaron Lee and Smith AI. They're amazing. And it really worked out. I mean, I've continued to do work for them years later, every now and then. I haven't done some work for them in a long time, but, you know, I could always, can't really count on them. Not that they always needed help, but they always were willing to bring me in if they always had work to do.
That's, you know, and I think about the aspirations of starting your own business. And I feel like that's a lot of times a big motivator, right? You might have some aspirations early in life to be an entrepreneur, to be your own boss, or to fulfill a certain itch. And it's part of what I do in these interviews is I try to dig deep on my research. And so I was mentioning earlier, before we hit the record button, how the first time I saw you ever in a shirt that was not black was just looking up some old stuff like 7 years ago on YouTube. But I also found your baseball card. So those that don't know, Pete McArts is a phenomenal baseball player played at Chico State. I have some stats here. So he set a record with 13 wins in a season. He also set a postseason record with 13 strikeouts. So that was in 2008. He's from the same area, San Jose, Gilroy area, which is great. But it was cool because it ends with what you plan to do once you graduate. And it says that you plan to open your own marketing firm. So
interesting.
It's called sales and marketing. So. Yeah. And maybe this is just something you said, but even back then when you were throwing heat, you were thinking about running your own business after college. So to find that it came to fruition, and even just like you fell into it, you know, that it's wild how these things happen. You know, some people are very intentional about it. I know I was very early, and whereas others are, you know, if it happens, it happens. And a lot of the folks I interview for the pod fall into consulting.
Yeah, it's I vividly remember that interview, and oddly enough, I still have my first ever win from CSU Chico against Fresno Pacific. Threw 5 innings, at 5 Ks, 0 walks, and gave up 4 hits. We won 5-0. Wow. This is my first start ever. But
for those that can't see the video, he's showing the ball that he has from that game. Yeah.
Yeah, I literally keep it on my desk. It's been on my desk since day one. But I knew I wanted to get into marketing, and I think that interview, the kind of the roots of that was my dad and stepmom had their own business in graphic design, PR. And I saw how fruitful their work was and how much they enjoyed it. And, you know, looking back and starting a marketing firm out of college, it's a bit of a daunting task. But, I think that's the life that I saw that I potentially wanted. And I think that's really what drove that answer. If you would have told me then I would have any sort of consulting firm at any point in time, I'd be like, you're crazy. Like, I don't know anything about any of that. If you would have told me I'd be in sales then, I would have probably laughed at you. But here we are. So there's that.
Well, you fulfilled it one way or the other. The stars aligned.
Yeah.
There's an interesting angle that I want to unpack with you about your record, your track record, I should say, and not your baseball card. But in terms of leadership and consulting, bringing those two worlds together, never on the show in our 40 some odd interviews have we had the opportunity to interview someone who's led consultants. So all of the interviews that I've had up until now with consultants have been independent consultants, with the exception of maybe one or two folks that maybe ran a consulting or professional services firm. Never have we unpacked what it's like to lead a group of consultants and kind of come up within those ranks and take that on. So, now I know I probably drove you nuts the times that at times, but no. Talk to me about that particular experience when you were at Ten Bound, our good friend David Delaney there. Hey, David. Talk to me about what goes through your mind as a leader of professional services in that realm, right? You are a VP of revenue, senior vice president of revenue there. Talk about that experience. It's a different angle than I've unpacked before.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's going to be different for any company out there, mm-hmm. right? I'd say the interesting part about the position that I was in was I was a consultant for quite a while before kind of scaling, growing that business and needing to hire more consultants, right? So doing the job and working a lot, because at that point we had grown quite a bit, I realized I was like, we need to bring somebody else in. Like, I can't keep, at one point I had 35 direct reports across like 5 different companies for fractional management, driving myself crazy, driving my family crazy, driving David crazy, I'm sure. I'm sorry, David. but it was to the point where it's like, okay, we need to bring someone else in. How do we do that? What profile do we look for? Right. And, we ran the gamut as far as who we were interviewing, from talking to SVPs of, Fortune 500 companies that had been there, done that, that were kind of pseudo retiring, that had, say, 20 hours a week and wanted to work, to, a very bright, motivated, sales manager at a tech company, to you, right, that had your own consulting company, specifically around kind of the tech space and Salesforce and that kind of thing, but also really had your hand in sales development and fracture management already, right? So you were a natural fit for it. And you really towed that line of, you know, being a consultant and being independent. And it was kind of, it really was a perfect fit for us at the time. Because one, I didn't have a lot of time to really mentor and coach and that kind of thing. So it's like, we need someone senior. We also want someone that is willing to take on this brand of Tenbound and kind of fold into the framework that we're building, right? So it was a really fine balance. That first hire, you were really critical, right? And it worked beautifully for a while there. It really did, until the economy started to dry up a little bit. But, you know, I thought we made a pretty darn good team. And
no, I think so too. We had a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, had a lot of fun. And it's really difficult to, as we all know, everyone has an ego, right? Especially in consulting, especially been doing it for a while, to have that knowledge base, to have that motivation, to be able to step into any situation and wrap your arms around this thing and really take control of it and, you know, push on and make everyone around you and the team better, right? And be able to identify areas and prescribe different improvements for those areas and implement them and then monitor them and track them, all those, everything that comes along with it, right? So it's incredibly difficult to really grow any consultant team,
right?
I'd say, especially at first, those first two, three, four hires are very critical. After that, I think by that time, you should have a framework as far as some training and some pieces. So you can potentially bring in some junior consultants that will fold in nicely into some of those kind of smaller engagements or specific engagements.
The fractions really of the engagement where we need
exactly.
Some.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's not an easy task. And right. There's definitely not a one size fits all by any means. But, you know, I would say towing that line of finding someone who's knowledgeable within your space, who's hungry and eager and motivated, at the same time, humble and willing to, you know, check their name at the door like you did.
Amazing. I was going to say, you're not talking about me anymore, are you?
No, we're talking about you. You're an amazing human first.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. And it worked really well, really well.
No, and for me, it was my first time working in a consultancy and not working by myself as a consultant. And it goes back to the premise of the question is, you know, leading that function, but also being part of that function. So for those that are out there who are running their own, you know, independent consultancy, single operator like myself, you know, it can help tremendously in gaining a lot of experience, right? Because we kind of had a machine already there at Tenbound. The content, the conferences, media packages, and in the consulting arm of the business. So for me, it allowed me to gain a lot more experience much faster than I would have on my own. As an individual, you might handle a handful or two clients a year. Whereas in an engagement like this, where we kind of already have this model of inbound clients and I don't have to do pre-sale, it's just contracts get signed and then you get assigned as the consultant that's going to support them. That model I think can definitely work. And for me, it was rapid fire, right? Getting into, you know, something like 15 different engagements within a year, was for me, a great learning lesson. It expanded the network, made some money, but yeah, we were working crazy hours. There's no doubt there were some wild hours there.
Reminds me of a conversation I had with David at first when he wanted to bring me on as a consultant. And you know, Tenbound at that point was dabbled in the consulting playbook kind of arena, right? Training, they're doing a lot of training stuff, but not really fractional management at all. Mm-hmm. They're really a media company, right?
Right.
With the podcasts and with the conferences and that piece of things. I remember jumping on with David and he was like, "No, what you're doing over at 0 to 20 is like, that's cute, but we have this whole machine that we've built.
Right, exactly.
Like, let's leverage this thing to go and sign business ultimately. Let's use this as a pipe gen type demand gen machine to get fractional management roles and build out playbooks and do all these things." And I remember sitting back and like, you know, he has a 7-year head start on me as far as the media goes. Like, sure, can I compete with it? Probably, right? Am I going to have to work 100 times as hard? Probably. And then once I got in there as a consultant, David's an amazing amazing human, amazing leader, and it just worked out. And we just started to really build things out together. But it was I remember him calling me cute, and that was definitely kind of the
He literally said cute, huh?
motivator to get me on that side. It was
Well,
everything was up in
sometimes,
the best
you got to
way.
join them. And what you just described, I feel like, is the premise of this show in some respects, because a lot of what I try to do is bring consultants on the show and learn from them and share their experiences with the audience. It's a form of research, it's a form of networking. And if I didn't have this platform, I think I might perceive, and they might as well perceive me as competition in some respects, depending on the fraction of what we're focused on, right? Not everybody that I interview as a consultant is in the same lane as me. But at 0 to 20, I'm sure you were helping to oversee and do fractional management of SDR teams and sales. So that, in this essence, is competition. 10-bound was direct. The thing to me was, at the times I had watched from the beginning of starting 3Link, 10-bound was like the mecca. It was the brand that you thought of when you thought about sales development in terms of thought leadership. And so to get that call from David was, to me, is like, I have arrived. I've
Yeah,
been
I'm here,
affirmed.
baby.
This isn't just me out here, shucking and jiving, trying to be this consultant dude. This is I'm legitimate. I'm
Yeah,
legitimate. I've been
I made a
validated.
name for
So
myself. Yeah.
yeah, it was good. Well, let's switch gears here. Tell me your thought process now, because today you're with Verisette. You're a director of sales again. I think you still have 0 to 20 running on the side, but you're in your full-time focus. So talk to me about that thought process now, because a lot of consultants are faced with either the opportunity to, where they're asked to join, a SaaS company, or what are their clients, for instance. I think that happened to me once in my career. But also, sometimes you have to do it out of necessity or life circumstances, right? So the reasons and the motivations might be different. But talk about the shift in motivation going from running 0 to 20, helping build 10-bound, being in the management consulting space, having a lot of impact on a lot of different companies and people like myself, to then saying, you know what, I'm going to change lanes and work for an organization full-time again. Now, this isn't a step back, just for those that are, I hear it a lot where people are saying, well, I'm going to go back to working for someone. And I don't see this that way. Unless you've built a multi-million dollar consultancy, this is always an option, and this is always a viable and respectable option. So talk to me about changing lanes from consulting back to working for someone on a W-2 basis.
It's, I mean, I agree 100% with you, and that I don't think it's a step back necessarily. I think, you don't know what you don't know. And you never know what someone's going through personally. Like for me personally, right? Having a conversation with the CEO, Kelso from Beyond, starting 0 to 20, working a few years in consulting, realistically, I was just kind of burnt out. I mean, I was working really long hours, and 10-bound, bootstrapped, media consulting company, right? So at the beginning, when we made the decision, okay, consulting is something that is fruitful for the business. Let's grow this kind of product set of fractional management. I was the flex. So if I was contracted for, I think at one point I was contracted for like 65 hours a week, right? And that was just the contracted work for clients. That wasn't even building the team. It wasn't even selling. It wasn't doing anything, but I was the one-man band doing that, of course, with David, a lot of David's help. So I was kind of the flex of like, okay, let's go hire somebody, try to transition a couple of these contracts to the new consultant, you being one of those, right? And it's like, okay, now I just found 20 hours in a week that I can go continue to build the business and then sign the business, okay, start it up, and then flex and sign a new consultant, good 4 or 5 at one point, right? So the workload consulting, especially if you're just a bootstrap startup or if you're by yourself, it can get immense very quickly, right? I'm
And trying to run a
talking,
podcast at the same time. Anyways, go
yeah,
ahead.
exactly. Podcasts take up hours, man. But I think, at that point in time, I just moved out to the East Coast with my wife. She was going back to school. I had nothing to do in the winter out here. I'm in Maine. Nothing to do in the winter out here other than work and ski every now and then, right? So, I mean, I joke about it now, but there was times where I literally didn't go outside for 2 weeks at a time. Like I would wake up, get to work, go to bed, eat in between and just working, 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 building, building. Do I look back at that and regret it? Not really, right? Because we're building something pretty special, pretty unique. At the same time, for me at that time, I was making a lot of money, right? It was incredibly fruitful financially, but it was also really fulfilling work. And I really enjoyed the speed at which these engagements were happening, right? You knew it was 3 months with this company. It was almost like a measuring stick that you could use. Say, okay, this is where we want to be in 3 months. This is where we are now. These are the major milestones we need to hit. Like, we're off the races. Let's fucking go, kind of thing, right?
That sprint, yeah.
And then, exactly. And then at 3 months, it's like, okay, we got another company that's vastly different than that previous, starting up the very next day. Let's go. So it was just this machine of consulting clients. And it was a lot of fun. And I remember David and I talking about it. And I'm like, I'm going to put my head down and sprint as fast as I can for a year. Literally put my head down, not go on a vacation, not do a damn thing for a full year. Come up for air at the end of that and see where we are. Right. And we always talked about that as like, okay, this is what we're buying into. This is what we're doing. And surely enough, I mean, we built a really solid business after that first year. And that's when I came up for air. I was like, okay, now we can start, you know, bringing on a couple outside consultants to come into the team, start to spread the work out a little bit more. Like, could I do that now with a 14-month-old upstairs, wife that's back at school, right? Getting her second master's degree? Absolutely not. Right. It's the timing of life, the timing of work and what you need in your professional career, right? I think there's a lot of push and pull factors that you have to kind of evaluate for your own personal self. Is this the right time? Is it the right time financially? Is it the right time for my family? Do I need health insurance? Can I afford health insurance if I do this on my own? Is this the experience that I want to gain, right?
Right. That's
do
an
I
important
enjoy?
One. Yeah. Is it still in line with what I want to do in the future as well? Is this going to go completely
exactly.
left? Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, in those couple of years, two and a half years working at Tendon, I think we worked with 68 companies or something total. All 60 of those companies, six of those companies were all companies in the exact same stage of the five companies I had worked for previously, for the most part, right? Right around that Series A, kind of Series B timeframe. So it was rapid fire, just learning literally through a fire hose again, which was great as a director of sales to get back on the ground floor and be a consultant and see everything. I really am grateful for that experience. At the same time, there is absolutely no way I could jump into that head first now, right? So the timing of everything really worked out. I don't see it as a deterrent necessarily. You could, of course, do it, even if all the factors are pushing against you. Like, for instance, have I ruled out going all in on 0 to 20 again at some point? No, definitely not. You know, do I itch for that fast-paced environment and working with, you know, 3 to 10 companies at a time? Of course, because it's fun and it's lively and exciting. It's also exhausting. But it's not that I didn't enjoy working for somebody or for a specific or a singular company. It was more about the timing of of my life choices, right?
Right.
And Verisa was an opportunity that came up through my network that was just odd. I actually had the recruiter call me asking if I knew anyone for the role. And I was like, actually, I may be a fit for that role. So, you know, it's going to vary by person and what the tolerance, your risk tolerance, what do you want
to
take on, right? From every aspect. And now, you know, it's been an amazing experience at Verisa. I've been there for over a year now. Team's growing. It's good, but not to
Talk
say
to me about
that,
the team aspect of it, because that's what I think about sometimes is, well, we had our team going there at 10, but respectively, we were all kind of off doing our own thing.
Well,
and you know, we would come together on a weekly basis and so forth. But, you know, when you're consulting, advising, fractionally leading, you're indirectly impacting this organization. You're not fully fledged. You're not part of the team, quote unquote. Was that a part of it? I mean, as a former, you know, team sports person,
oh, yeah.
right, playing baseball, that camaraderie of being on the squad, was that part of the draw too?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no getting around that. I mean, there was days where I would, you know, carry out 14 one-on-ones with three different companies, right? Knowing that 2 months from now, I'm not going to be speaking to these people probably ever again for the most part, right? And not that that's like some weird realization by any means, but I definitely, those days where I just yearned for that connection of being in the same boat with everyone, marching toward the same direction, right? And we're all on the same mission together and bought in together, right? And I looked at that and I was like, okay, how can I kind of manage this with building an internal team of consultants and having a flair of that we're all in this together as a team of consultants, but we all are doing our own thing too, right? And it's that fine balance of, hey, we're a team here at 10 Bound, even though I think everyone had their own businesses outside of 10 Bound too. So it was, I don't want to discount the team we had, quote unquote, at 10 Bound,
Right,
right?
right.
There was something special about that core group of us there for sure. At the same time, like, being a W-2 employee at a singular company, there's something different, right? It's you're 100% bought in. You have to be to have success in a startup environment and all march in the same direction. So it's there was absolutely days where I just yearned for that, like, oh, I wish we could be bought in. And there's times where you wish you had some authority at times too as a consultant
Influence is
to
great, but the authority,
make sweeping changes that need to be made. It doesn't matter, how much you iterate on process or anything, if these things aren't changed, it's not going to change anything. So, being a part of a singular team under a singular logo definitely has its advantages as well.
Well, you mentioned your parents earlier. So I'm gonna get personal with you real quick and
Let's
change
do
lanes.
it.
We're heading towards the end of the interview, but before we do, I know you personally, and I think one of the most interesting things about you is this book you received when you were 30 years old. Your mom wrote you a book while you were growing up, sort of a journal of sorts, right? And thoughts and memories and things that were happening at that time. And she gave that book to you when you turned 30, which is to me phenomenal. I have a lot of pictures. My mom has a photo albums. I don't know for kids. There's a thing called photo albums. That's physical pictures in them.
Some Polaroids, maybe those are coming
yeah,
back.
no, literally. So when I go to her house, I to this day I still flip through these pictures, and it brings back all this nostalgic memories and everything else. So, but to read your mother's thoughts of what if about you and the experiences of growing up and whatnot. I got a kind of a multi-framed question here. So, what was the biggest aha from that book? And you kind of touched on it earlier, but how did what your parents do influence your career choices, as an adult?
That's a loaded question. We can get into that. I could take 3 hours on this podcast,
Yeah,
but
and you only have about 2 minutes to answer the question, so.
perfect. Okay. So yes, my mom did give me the book. We had no idea. In fact, I think she gave my brother his, and he didn't even tell me that he received it, right? So the whole thing with how my mom deciding to when to give it to us is she decided when we were ready. We could have been 18, we could have been 40.
Late
And
bloomer
she
there, huh,
thought,
Pete?
apparently, I started puberty at 27. So there's that. No, but yeah, it was really interesting to read the times where she was frustrated as a mom, as a human. Where she was frustrated with us kids, right? And why she was frustrated. At the same time, it was awesome to read why she was proud of us in random times of us meeting somebody on the street that maybe she worked with, right? And my brother's 3 years older, so we were like 7 and 10 at the time. And we met somebody at the grocery store and we stood there, sat up straight and shook a man's hand, looked him in the eye, and said, "Nice to meet you." We both did that, right? Without my mom's, guidance or kind of pushing us to do that. And one of the interviews, she mentioned how she couldn't wait to get home and write about it because she was so proud of us for doing that, right? That she didn't have to tell us anything. Starting to tear up. But it's really cool to read some of those things, right? It's generally exactly why I have my book that I'm writing to my daughter in. So I keep this on my desk, and just if I need 5, 10 minutes here and there, I'll write something, that I have a thought on. From challenges of that I'm going through, that we're going through, my wife Colby and I are going through. It brings this human element. I mean, even you can revert it back to business, right? And executives and leadership, that the end all be all in your life, mom and dad, usually, right? You think they have all the answers. They have none of the answers, and they're just working through it, just like just
winging it.
being a mom or dad. Now, of course, you have the experience, right, and kind of the wherewithal to make some of these choices. But you know, it's really cool to view it from that lens of I have no idea what how to raise two young boys as a single mom, right? I just like I have no idea how to raise a little girl, but you better damn believe I'm trying my hardest, right? And there's going to be times where I'm wrong. That's perfectly fine. And to kind of tie it back to executives, even today, right? Most executives, I don't care if you're a Fortune 10 CEO, right? There's going to be times where you're a person first. Everyone is a person. They have their own personal drivers, their own drivers at work, right?
Own
And
stressors outside of
to,
work.
oh yeah. And you don't know what they're going through. You don't know what the priorities are. But at the end of the day, if you can appeal to that human element, and people do business with people they like and they trust, right? That's what it always comes down to. Of course, product is a huge piece of that as well, but it's a whole other conversation. But it was really cool to see the human aspect of my mom, because I always put her on this pedestal that she was, you know, her word was it, right? And to read in some of her entries of, I said this, I have no idea if it's right or wrong, but you boys did it, right? So it was pretty cool to read through some of that, and I pull it out every now and then to continue reading it. But for the most part, I write to my daughter now. But yeah.
Lot of leadership lessons in that. A
Oh yeah.
lot of life and leadership lessons. You can definitely see some parallels in that respect. Leaders that are trying to figure it out, people who are set top performers, they're promoted to management, that have to figure it out. And but you know, they've never done it, but better believe they're going to do all they can. And then to see that you're doing the same thing with for your daughter. I mean, again, the
Yeah.
influence that sets, right? That creates some level of tradition. Maybe she'll do the same
Yeah.
thing for her kids, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought that's really cool and something I might borrow from you. I missed the opportunity with my kids. They're all adults now, but I have a couple of grandkids, so I think I can start with
I
them.
was gonna say it's a perfect it definitely it humanizes kind of your heroes growing up, right? That's the biggest piece to me.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate you
Yeah.
opening up about that and, you know, thinking back to the question about where your head was at with making the transition from consulting to, you know, taking on the full-time role. I think Austin played a big part in
Yeah.
that. You know, I was there
Yeah.
when this happened. So,
Yeah.
yeah, that's always a beautiful thing, and I can absolutely understand that. All right, let's close it out with some rapid fire. Okay, and
Let's do
then
it.
so I have five rapid fire questions for you.
All right.
Let's see how succinct you can keep it and how clear you
Ooh,
can be.
okay. All right. Let's do
AI in
it.
sales. AI in sales, is it a game changer or is it just more tech making more noise?
Game changer if used correctly.
Okay, you're allowed to elaborate on that one.
I think, I mean, right now it's this big flashy object, right? That
Okay,
I
right.
think everyone jumped on this train. And there are absolutely ways to leverage it within a process, within sales, within a lot of pieces. And to a certain aspect, I think my hot take, if you will, on it is it is. Has the potential to really stain young salespeople's work ethic and abilities early on if you're leveraging this as it can be leveraged, right? Again, getting back to the human element, we're all humans. We can see when something is written with AI, right? And we can personalization emails, all these different aspects of AI they can leverage. At the end of the day, and AI is not going to meet with a prospect. And AI is not going to negotiate with a prospect. And AI is not going to dig for how you can be a resource to this person, much less company. Can it help you do some research of how to get in front of this person and details about their life that may be, you know, will be a great hook in an email? Sure. Write the email for you? Absolutely not. Can it, you know, improve and shorten the time frame of, you know, everything that goes into the prospecting process? Sure. But it needs to have some pretty firm kind of bumpers on this thing to use it correctly. And you know, I never want to see it fully take over. I don't think it'll ever take over all the sales aspects together, but I do think it absolutely, from the forecasting and the whole back end aspect of metrics to, you know, researching specific prospects and companies and all these kind of things, it's just this wealth of information. But then it's going to take a human to put that information to good use, in my opinion.
I love the perspective on that. Next question. Remote or on-site?
Yeah, hot takes all around. Senior salespeople, specifically sellers, no issue being remote. Young, early salespeople, there is, in my mind, to me, there is absolutely nothing that can replace the camaraderie, the learning, the speed at which you can grow and excel as a person, as a team, as a company when you're in person, especially with, you know, a group of 20 somethings. If you have, you know, a team of five or a team of 20 under 25 year olds, that is their first or second job. There is nothing that can replace that camaraderie and that time in the office and everything that comes along with that. I highly encourage people, if you can do that, please do that. There's nothing like it, right? At the same time, you know, life gets in the way of things. And once you have some of that experience, and say you're a career salesperson, as enterprise AE, you know, you can make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year living in Montana or Maine.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I think the it depends where you are, depends what position, depends what seniority, but there's a time and a place for both.
Got it. I was reading a report from the Bridge Group. They did a 2023 sales development report, and it talked about the distribution of SDR teams. And a couple quick interesting stats: fully remote work from home, about 54% of the respondents. So that we're still in that state of, you know, and I guess, and this is definitely left over from COVID and so forth. But what was interesting is a breakout statistic is that they broke it out by revenue size. So the bigger the company, the more people that they had on site. It, to the point of 76% of people, if they were 250 million or more in revenue, 76% of the time SDRs were on site. Right.
Interesting.
And then the other percentage is either in office or hybrid, I'm sorry, fully remote or work from home. So that 76% includes hybrids. So, and there's a tad bit of remote there, but it literally just, as you get smaller into sub 5 million, it's the complete opposite where it's 75% fully remote work from home.
I think that's a little troubling, right? In my opinion, I think the earlier stage companies, and I understand the whole talent argument of, you know, casting a wider geographic net for attracting better talent. I 100% get that. But again, in my opinion, there is nothing that can replace a small team getting off the ground in office together, being able to tap your CEO on the shoulder to be like, hey, this team, let's talk about this, or your VP of sales or CS product, whoever it may be, right? There's nothing that can replace the speed at which you can learn and grow in an office, right? And I think that the bigger companies, for lack of a better term, just want accountability. So they brought everybody back. They wanted to make sure that people were actually working because they're big companies, right? They have a lot of layers of management, all these different aspects. Whereas smaller companies, I mean, they a lot of times are led by younger founders, younger CEOs.
And I think it's just the overhead cost of having a facility, a building. I mean, we see commercial real estate, 50% of buildings are vacant because it's so damn expensive. And so there's other, there's cost factors there. So there's a talent argument, but there's also this, can we afford at this early stage to sign a lease where we can bring folks in?
There's definitely, I mean, it's a huge aspect. I mean, there's the co-working, the WeWorks of the world, or God knows how many. I mean, I think there's a dozen co-working spaces within 10 miles of me. I'm in Southern Maine. So when there's even smaller budgets, there's a place and a, you know, that you guys can all get to, anyone can get together, right? I just think that the familiarity, the comfortableness with younger and smaller teams, being okay with working remote is just kind of innate and built into them, right?
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, they have offsites for a reason. Almost every remote team has an offsite for a reason. Oh, we're going to save that for the offsite, training for the offsite, or whatever it may be for the offsite. Like, why do they do that? Because it's so much more impactful when you guys
you're
run
in
together.
Person, right?
So there's something to be said about that.
Yeah. And it goes back to the question: if you could meet with your prospect, your ideal prospect, who's ready to buy, has budget, it's a perfect circumstances. Would you rather meet with them over a Zoom call, or would you rather meet with them in person in their office, sitting at their desk? I think it's an obvious answer. So
yes, I mean, it goes back to the days. Those 3 or 4 years there, I was taking 100 flights a year. So, it was battling as far as just being a home. But again, there's nothing to replace meeting someone in person, much less working with your folks in person, when and if you can.
Okay. So since we're on the sales development topic, and I was bringing up that data, what are your thoughts on the future of sales development? Is it increasing in adoption, or is it a dying model?
Oh man, you are just burning questions here. I don't think it's a dying model. I think it will evolve a bit. I think that, the idea of having such a singular purpose of sales development, building pipeline that spreads across, right? Is it too narrow of a scope for a full position? Potentially, right? Full cycle AEs, or something we said for that. Demand gen, working directly with AEs, sure, right? I think there's a time and a place. And if I learned anything consulting, companies, industries, ICPs, personas, there's infinite combinations, right? If you're not designing your team structure to fit with who you're selling to, you're doing something wrong. And if sales development is not working, then try to diagnose why it's not working. It may be sales development may not be the best fit for that organization. It's entirely possible, right? Now, how do you develop pipeline and do all of that? You still have to figure all that out, right? If you don't have a sales development function. But I think it will evolve somewhat. And I think the general breadth and scope of what sales development is going to widen a little bit compared to the prototypical we've seen before of smiling down and sending out emails. That kind of
thing. And not just new acquisition, but actually getting into existing customer base, going back to the healthy growth model as opposed to
Correct.
Growth at all risks. Why not deploy SDRs to nurture and be proactive with our existing customer base? Our CS teams are stretched thin. We know we want them to be proactive, helping customers reach those objectives, but they turn into break fix teams most often, unfortunately, and being reactive to client requirements. And our AEs are, I think for the most times the same thing, where they're stuck in that sales cycle. And that's where we want them, is proving value, negotiating, doing those later stage things. And so, I love that perspective of getting wider in our focus.
Yeah, getting wider. And also, I think that it's kind of, for whatever reason, the sales development aspect has kind of burned this AE of give me leads or give me teed up qualified opportunities and I'll close them. And I think there's this overlap mechanism that has just gotten kind of thrown out in the wash, that a lot of AEs don't know how to prospect, much less dig for pain, much less understand a prospect and what they're actually selling, because they have that teed up for them, right? If you actually understand how to reach out to a specific ICP with a specific problem that you potentially can fix or be a resource to, right? Rather than why are we on this call today and what can I do to get you to sign this contract?
Hashtag
a lot of those skills
mm-hmm.
are just kind of left by the wayside. So I think the AE's focus is probably going to shift a little bit towards earlier in the sales funnel. At the same time, if you have a sales development function, it may shift a little bit towards the marketing aspect of it and the demand gen aspect of how can we get involved in that. Just kind of shift everything backwards a little bit. But time will tell. We'll see.
Love it. All right. Last two questions.
Yep.
Number one, social selling and thought leadership. Is it a nice to have for a salesperson, or is it essential to a sales strategy?
Oh boy. Again, I hate to be this guy that's just a constant fence straddler, but there's a time and a place for everything. It depends on your brand.
You're such a consultant. It depends.
I'm such a consultant. I was thinking about this last night, actually, and who's the Peter Thiel company in Palo Alto that if you work for them, you couldn't tell them you work for them? What was it? It's that company. It's a defense contractor type company, right? I think they're publicly traded now. They're a massive company, and for whatever reason, I'm blanking on the name. But basically, if you were asked, if you worked for them, you had to say, no, I have no idea what you're talking about, kind of thing. So there are companies out there that don't want press, right? There are companies out there that don't want to be known, right? That want to be the back-end solution that powers the Microsofts, Intels, HPs,
the forget world, about right? us, and we just grow with in the background. Yeah,
exactly. So I appreciate the whole LinkedIn thought leadership, brand building aspect of things. Obviously, I know a lot of people that have done it and done it successfully. You being one of those people, right? And I admire you.
Not top voice yet. Give me that top voice.
You'll get there. No problem there. I admire those people that have been able to do that. It's something I've waffled on for a long time.
I still do myself. Right? The thing that goes around in my head, man, is I don't want to post just to post. And I feel like that's what I see most often of is people aren't engaging with content. They're posting content. So fundamentally, it's misbalanced. You have a bunch of people putting a bunch of stuff up there, which in a lot of cases is really good content. But it's, you know, it dwarfs the level of like conversations that they're having. So, and then there's this, you know, because I have to post every day, I have to appease the algorithm, and, you know, it becomes this echo chamber in some respects. And I don't want to contribute to that, too much. You can't help it in some regards, but that's why I wanted to get your perspective. I know, you know, you are definitely in the realm. You've hosted a lot of conversations. You've been on a lot of podcasts. You've ran podcast interviews. So you understand that game of content and thought leadership, but is it for a salesperson or for a sales leader, for a consultant? Is it a nice to have, or is it really, can you get it how you live? You know, I do cold outreach. I acquire customers through my network. I don't get a lot of inbound from pieces that I post on LinkedIn, you know?
I mean, I think it depends what you're thinking or how the potential company, or if you're interviewing somebody or whatever, how you're potentially going to leverage that, right? If at all. Like I was just, as you were talking right now, I'm like, have I ever asked that in an interview or thought about like how many followers this person had or how many times they post? It has never crossed my mind ever, right? Candidly, I could give a shit whether you have a following on LinkedIn or not.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you.
I really
it seems like
don't
that's the
care.
That's when we talk about your baseball card. the more and more I look at the landscape, I feel like that still becomes part of the line items of, well, what number of followers do you have and how much engagement do you get? And look, it's effective. It works. There's no doubt about it. There's no, but I don't think everybody needs to be a thought leader is my perspective.
Absolutely not. Everyone does not need to be a thought leader.
You can't.
At the same time, you've heard the stories, I'm sure, of it working against people, right? They don't want to bring folks on that have 10, 20, 30,000 followers. They don't want to be associated with that because what they say is going to reach a lot of people. And if that company has a bad relationship with that person at any point, you have 30 plus thousand people that are seeing that firsthand, right? So it's a bit of a double-edged sword there for a company to bring on something like that as well. So I've heard stories firsthand from folks that are like, we are not going to hire you because of your following, point blank. So I think it's something to consider. I'm not.
And then there's the stories of managers who are telling people to take their content down, where people are posting stuff and they're asking them,
exactly.
They're trying to, you know, monitor what they're putting up. So
it's
definitely a hot topic. That's why I wanted to get your perspective on it. And I love just your realness about it. Like, I could give a shit about your following. Can you do the job?
Yeah.
Are you an expert in your field? You don't need to have the bullhorn attached to your, you know, mouth to prove that out.
Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, I think the people a lot of times that work inside of companies versus the persona they're projecting on LinkedIn, can be a pretty big gap in those two different, whether it's skill sets, knowledge bases, or just who they are. I'm not saying that to be inflammatory by any means, but
it's a real thing.
It's just how the world works, right? If you're projecting out to gain followers, to build your personal brand, there's going to be discrepancies between that and your actual work product. There's going to be. So, you know, I don't care. I view it as what am I hiring for? How are you going to fit in with the team? Where do you want to go with your life? Where do you want to go with your career? You know, the whole brand LinkedIn aspect of it, that's you. Like, do your thing. If it's going to help us, great. If it's going to hurt us, I got to take that into consideration for the company I'm hiring for, sure. But, you know, No, it's not someone tips the scales either way for me right now.
Okay, final question. Environmental conditions or individual skill? What of those, which of those I should say, takes the cake in terms of sales success in a sales team? Is it the
Oh
individuals
man.
and their talents and abilities, or is it the environment that we create as leaders and the the environment, not just the off, maybe it's the office, maybe
Yeah,
it's how we
yeah.
communicate, it's the culture. So which of those two things are you going to take?
I'm gonna go with the individual skill motivations of an IC or of an individual. I
Okay.
mean, you look at you can create anything, right? You really can't, whether it's a team, whether it's a culture, all these different aspects. But if you candidly haven't done a good job of hiring great human, I think we've talked about this guy so many times when we used to work together at Tenbaum. I want to hire great humans, like just good, solid, whole people, right? That are damn good at what they do. And they're going to fold into the team like nothing ever happened, right? And then we're all going to just march off and continue marching on. We just added a whole nother skill set to us, whole nother person, whole nother perspective that we all appreciate and can rally around. And that's a kind of a culture and everything built within itself, right? But there's going to be successful people inside toxic environments. There's always going to be. There's also going to be not so successful people in amazing environments, right? So the environment, sure, is something that can uplift everybody. It can also bring everybody down. It's not the end all be all. If you have great people, great individuals, they're going to succeed. They're going to fail regardless of the situation they're put in, I'd like to think, depending on specific motivations, that kind of thing. But if I don't think they're mutually exclusive by any means. I think that
Right, they're
they're a
not.
lot of times one and the same, right? But if you are a successful, driven, skillful executive professional, you're going to succeed in almost any situation you're put in. So to me, that kind of negates the whole culture aspect of it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Sales Consultant Podcast. If you'd like to support the show, it would go a long way if you were to write a short review on the listening app of your choice.